All righty, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Dan P. from Artesia.
I'm going to put the water down here because I'll short something out probably. Everybody, my name is Dan Pavelford. And I am a very grateful member of this wonderful fellowship of ours. I don't think if I hadn't gotten here 26 years ago that I'd be your speaker tonight. I'd be buried by now, probably at Forest Lawn in Cypress, where my dad and my brother are, because for some reason I ended up in this fellowship, and my dad never ended up in AA, and my brother never found this fellowship. And I'll just tell you what it was like for me growing up. That's what I always do. And I tell you, you know, the blessings that I've had of finding this fellowship when I did, for some reason I got here. I don't know why. Maybe it'll make sense to you as I share. And then all of the incredible things that have happened in my life. I know I am a blessed man, and I have a sponsor that always tells me to get dressed up when I speak, and he says, always have a bottle of water because you cry all the time, Dan, because I dehydrate, so... Yeah, you'll see that probably along the way. Something will happen that will cause that trigger mechanism to come off. The sponsor I have today is a man that I've learned to be contrary to what I grew up with. And you'll see why as I tell the story. Anyway, in the middle of it, there's five of us. There's my dad, my mom, and the three kids. I had an older brother and myself, who's the middle guy, and a younger sister. And I don't know why I got the part of the gene pool that I did, but I should have been born with a pair of referee stripes on, because that's what I felt my job was to do. My dad would come home. He was a bar drinker. He drank whatever, you know. And he'd come home at night. Didn't matter if it was 6 o'clock at night. You know, my mom thought it was important for us all to eat dinner as a family together. They both grew up in the Depression, my folks. So she'd start cooking dinner about 6 o'clock at night normally. And my dad, depending on where he was at and where his drinking took him to, we would eat sometimes at 6 o'clock, sometimes at 7 o'clock, sometimes at midnight. It just depended on when he got home. And I remember my dad liked ground round. That was kind of like one of his favorite meals. And then all these crazy vegetables that I still don't eat today, like turban squash and weird stuff that just, like, you looked at it, it didn't look good to me. And you know, a piece of ground round looks pretty good when you eat it, when you make it at 6 o'clock. But if it's been cooked over and over again till about 10 o'clock, it's kind of like a briquette or a hockey puck, you know. You couldn't even eat the thing. If you tried to swallow it, you'd choke on the thing. But that's what it was like, you know. We would have that. And it was also a big deal in our living room. We had a couch that was like in an L shape. You know, a lot of people have that in their homes. It's kind of like the real nice, comfortable area. In my house today, it is. My daughter and my wife and I just lounge all over it. In our house, when I grew up in it, we all had exact positions where we had to sit. And my dad would get home from work, you'd see the lights coming up the driveway, and my mom would say, everybody snap to, you know, dad's coming, and you didn't know if he's going to be pissed or happy or what he was going to be. And he'd come in, and he always liked to go to the LA County Fair, and one year they had Seberg, they're the ones that make the jukeboxes. Well, some guy came up with the idea he could put LP records in a gigantic cabinet. It had like 50 slots for records in it. And my dad he loved Frank Sinatra music. And we had every Frank Sinatra rock record in this thing. And it had a rotary dial on it. So he'd come in, you know, whatever way he was, most of the time drunk. And he'd ask my mom to make him a martini. He'd shake his hand like this, and she'd do that. And we'd all take our positions. And he'd hit the rotary dial and press all play. But every night it was the same record. We never got past about a record and a half. You know, it's like it was like water torture. Every night you hear the same music over and over again. You go, oh my God. And I look at my brother and said, well, you have to go through this again. It's terrible. And I was just a little kid telling my older brother that. And he just looked at me and said, you just shut up, you know, don't cause a problem. Okay, well. You know, it's funny, though, when Frank Sinatra, I think he died about 10 years ago, maybe longer. Now, I really lose track of time, the decades, the months are like weeks to me now, the years are like a month, and we're over another year, you know, and that's just kind of the way it goes for me. But when he died, most of the radio stations were playing a lot of his music, you know, we got past the first and second record. A lot of times he would jump around, and you know, I'm kind of making it an example of where he enjoyed that music, and I really, that was one of the gifts I got from my father. I love that music too. I love the melodies, and I know all the words and all of that, so that was one of the side benefits of growing up in a crazy home that I grew up in, was that, and learning to try and digest undigestible food, you know, that was part of it too. But you know, being a boy growing up in a home that was affected by the disease of alcoholism, like I was, and I think a lot of the gentlemen here, and I like what the one man said here, I believe, you know, all of us that get here are gentlemen. I say we learn to grow up and be responsible, and I don't feel like I'm a victim any longer. And I know so many guys in this room, it's amazing. You know, I've been around here a long time, and I have a lot of really nice personal experiences with a lot of you, and it's like coming home, you know. And that's one of the real blessings of this too, is all the nice people that you meet and all the fine examples that are out there of how to grow up and be a man. And you know, that home, we're, you know, we always, like, I don't know what it was with my dad, my brother contracted diabetes when he was 12 years old, and back in that, at that time period in the late 50s, the treatment was really poor. They didn't know how to, you know, to check your blood sugar and all that kind of stuff, and he was very small, and he didn't look healthy. And I remember my dad was so ashamed of having a sick kid. That's what he used to say, my son is sick. And we would sterilize syringes at night. You know, I helped my mom do it. The needles were really long, and we used glass syringes. And don't tell anybody your brother's a diabetic. The only one that knew was the school nurse. So my brother got sick many, many times. You know, that's the way it is in alcoholic homes. You know, the weird way that people think, like what they're ego's affected by the drinking and whatever, and everybody else is affected by it. And because my dad was so ashamed of that, well, his big deal was, okay, I'm going to toughen you up. So he was going to make my brother be a football player. My brother had no business being a football player. He looked like a twig, you know, and he couldn't do it. Well, one night around our fancy L-shaped green couch we had, that's where all of our meaningful conversations happened too. It was always mostly about how his day went at work, and everybody kind of screwed him around, and then he'd take it out on us, or he'd come in and everything went great and everything would be fine. And I believe, you know, my dad was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He would come in, and some days he'd be the greatest dad in the world, and other days he'd be the meanest S of a B you could think of. You know, it was, and I tried my damnedest to do everything the same all the time. I tried to be a good kid, not get in trouble, and one day I'd be the good kid, and the next day I'd be I'd be at the whipping post. And that just was the way it was. You could never really figure out the dynamic of it. So anyway, my brother, we're in the front room, and my dad's going to teach him how to block and tackle and all this, so he gets my brother out there and knocks him all over the place, knocks one of the green couches over and all of that. And I was 6 years younger than my brother, and I'm sitting there watching him going, I'll get my chance one day. I don't have his problem, and I'm pretty healthy, and I'm going to wait for my opportunity to take care of my brother's business. So about 6 years later, when I was a freshman in high school, I was playing football, and I was pretty good. And my dad said, okay, you show me what you can do. I said, okay. So I knocked him. We got in alignment, and I knocked him over the green couch. I knocked him into our dining room table and broke it. He got up, and I knocked him out through the other room, out through the plate glass window. So I get up, and he gets up, and he looks at me like startled, and I'm going, and this is how I believe an adult child or a child an alcoholic. I saw that look in my dad, and I was so ashamed. I said, how could I do that to my dad? He's my dad. Man, if he asked me to stand on a railroad track in front of him and protect him, I'd do it because he's my dad. And I got a real buzz out of it for like about 30 seconds, and then after that, I was ashamed. But I jump around a little bit because I kind of have to. I'd been in the fellowship for a long time, and when I made an amends to my father, I told him, Dad, remember that time I knocked you through the plate glass window and around that? I said, yeah, I remember that. I said, I really feel bad I did. They said, why? I went to the bar the next day, and I told all the guys, and they thought it was the greatest thing in the world. That's how screwed up my head is. That's the way, you know, I've heard people share about, like, they have this big thing, and they tell somebody something, and they have this resentment. And then they see a guy 20 years later, said, I don't even know what you're talking about. And that's how it was for me, you know. And I went to school, and I flunked first grade, second grade, and third grade. I don't know how many people ever did that. But, you know, and I think if I was at the time where Ritalin and all that was available, they'd have been packing that in my mouth, too. But, you know, I know today there's a lot of people out there that are doing that. This is my opinion. They're just affected. The kids are affected by this disease, and that's what happens. I didn't need that stuff. I needed attention. So I'd sit in the front row and act like I couldn't hear in the class. I could hear everything perfectly fine. And they all were trying to figure out, and I'd get attention. I'd go to the nurse. They'd go, you hear that? No, I can't hear anything. I'm telling stories now I never even thought about. I don't know where they're all coming from, but I guess that's what this night's supposed to be about, I guess. So anyway, the principal has this great idea. She's letting me walk down the corridor and say, Danny, can you hear me? And I'm just, I know I can hear her. Can you hear me? She's yelling. And I just act like I couldn't hear her, but I did. But I said, this is great. I'm getting attention because I got to go into her office and she talked to me and everything. And you know, that's how I got attention, you know. And I'll tell you, I think a lot of boys that grow up in the homes like I did, I was a bedwetter till I was 14. I was an ear picker until I got here. I shook my leg so much, if you could have hooked a cable to it, I could have probably powered up one of the rooms in my house. I was just and so full of fear that I couldn't tell you. That was my dad's. One of his big things that he did, he made, you know, fear was a big factor that could get me motivated. Never in a good way for me, but today I'm still that way. I be at work and someone can set me off and my mind's going all over the place and worrying about things I have no control over. But thank God I've got this fellowship and a good sponsor and guys and gals I can go to and go to meetings and get that all squared away because, you know, that was just who I am and why I had to be the one in the family who felt it was their responsibility to keep mom and dad together. My dad's always threatened to divorce my mom and my mom would start crying and I say, Mom, it'll be okay. And Dad, well, I'm like the guy plugging the holes in the dike trying to stop the water from coming in, but it was impossible to stop it all. It was just crazy. The other thing that happened in that home when we moved from the living room into the little kitchen where we sat in the same sequence. It was my mom, my sister, my dad, and then my brother and I on the other side. And it was, you know, we either had spaghetti or we had this ground round stuff. The ground round doesn't throw well, but the spaghetti does. And my dad and my brother would get into it. I don't know why these two guys did. That was my brother's thing. You know, I think he was pissed at my dad because of the deal with being the sick kid and all of that. And my dad would be going off, and he would tell him something like, why do we have to listen to your stuff? Why don't we talk about what's going on with us, Dad? And, oh, that didn't go over well. And then they'd say something back and forth, and then this plate of spaghetti would be diagonally across the table flying all over, and my brother would run out of the house with my dad chasing him, and my sister would be sent to the neighbors, and nobody did anything about me because they knew I'd just stay there and try and pull them all back together who's left in the house. And you know, and that's what I did. I did that all the time, and I did that all of my life. And until I got here, that was just what I thought I had to do, you know. And, well, I finally, school got better for me. That was kind of my way out. The sixth grade, I had a lady that was, you know, they talk about like the Eskimos that come into your life that save you. I think I was at a point in my life, being around that age, where I didn't want to live anymore, really. I was so sick and tired of it. I was tired of my dad being mad at me, and I couldn't understand why, and all that sort of thing. And this lady had moved here from Florida. Her husband was in the Air Force, and he was trying to be an astronaut. And she got me all turned on to the space race. It was like 1965 or 66, and we were all, you know, Kennedy had us all going. We were going to go to the moon and everything. And I got to go with this teacher. She took us over to North American Aviation, which was in Downey. I live in Artesia. And we got to do a tour of where they're building the Apollo space capsule. And we walk in there, and two guys come out of this space capsule. It was Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong. And I got to meet both of those guys. I was a little boy and a young boy, and it just like turned me on to that. All I wanted to learn about was that, you know. And this lady, I got in her class by some miracle because I'd flunked the first, second, and third grade. I was reading like not even third grade level or anything. I couldn't do math. I was a mess. So she put me in remedial reading and remedial math and everything. And within like 6 months, I was reading eighth grade level, doing eighth grade math, all this stuff. So my dad thought he had a genius on his hands now, and he was really excited all about it. The funny story is years later, I don't think I've ever shared this either. It's kind of weird that my remedial teacher was one of my dad's drinking buddies at Puccini's in Artesia. David knows about that. It's funny. I don't want to break anonymity or anything, but or stories, but we have a long history back. We're construction guys, and our families were intermeshed. I've known him since he was a little boy, and we have very similar stories. But, you know, that lady, I got to do all these really cool things, and we built, my dad did this work at a plastics factory, and I got like a dome from some kind of a jet or something, and we made like this little, like when we'd gone to the moon, we were going to have some kind of like a geodesic dome thing where we were going to be living in that, and we decorated all that. It was really cool, and I was so proud of what I had done and some of the other kids had done. And the night we had an open house, my dad came. He came drunk, and he made a big scene about how hokey it looked. And then he proceeded to go over and tell off the math teacher that my brother didn't like. So it just turned into one of those kind of nights. It was full of excitement. And the next day, the teacher comes in, and she says, Danny, she says, do you think your dad's an alcoholic? And I didn't know what that word meant. I thought she said, like, you think your dad's a mass murderer or a killer? Because that's the way I just said, man, you know, no, my dad's a great guy. That's why I said, no, my dad's a nice guy. I don't want to talk about it. Leave me alone. And that kind of doomed that for us. It was near the end of the year, but I had that 1 year where things were good. And then one more time, the lies, the stories you tell, the bigger story you could tell in my house, the more attention you got. We were all compulsive liars, full of fear. Bedwetters, name it. You know, my brother was the same way. We were just all messed up, just the way it was. But, you know, what my attention shifted to sports after that. I got into high school, and I was a good in sports, and I got to stay out late. I could stay out till 10 o'clock. I didn't have to come home, and that was my avenue out. I didn't have to come home and sit at the green couch with my sister and my brother, and I was allowed to get away from that. And so I was a late stayer at school, and I did all that, and I did really good in high school, and to the point where my senior year, I was like captain of the team, and then my wife, who's here with me tonight, Diane, I'd had a crush on her since like fourth grade. It was, and she didn't even know it. You know, that's just the way it was for me. And for the homecoming thing, she asked me if I would escort her to the event. And in my mind, this is the way my Al-Anon, pre-Al-Anon crazy mind was. She asked me to marry her, and I pursued her like crazy from then on, to the point where she said, just leave me alone, you know. And I think if she would have, nowadays she'd have had a restraining order put on me, I'm sure. But that's how compulsive, that I compulsed on that. I said, you know, I'm going to marry this girl, you know, and I'm just going to blah, blah, blah. I had the experience in my life that really affected me, probably my defining moment of really bad, something bad, was we had done the grad night, or they had grad night. It was the first time she said, well, yeah, you can hang around me with grad night if you want. I'm going, oh, great, I'll get all dressed up and have a good time. And so we stayed out all night, you know, and come home. We were at Disneyland. And my dad didn't like sick kids or lazy kids. During the summer, I never went to the beach, and I worked on the job. I swept floors, I pounded nails, I poured concrete, I did whatever. That's just what I did. And we got back, and I believe in homes like I grew up in too. Grandpa is more like dad, like dad. My dad was so tied into what he was doing. He had his agenda. He worked very hard. My dad was really good at what he did. He drank hard, he played hard, it just who he was, and he wanted his kids to be the same way, you know, no idle time at all. So I got back from that, I was exhausted. He said, take Grandpa and go out to Garden Grove and put this for sale sign on our property. I said, Dad, I'm too tired, I'll fall asleep, I can't drive right now. He said, my dad could give me this look, even to the day he died. He was 90 when he died, or no, 80 when he died. I wish he'd lived to 90, but he didn't make it that long. But he'd give me this look, and it's the look that, like, of terror and like being pissed off at him and everything. And I reacted, and I'd do whatever he would tell me to do. And we got in this car, and I took my best friend with me, the guy that would take me to Dodger games and fishing, and I could go to his house, and we talk a little bit. Right now, our family members are in the process of selling my grandpa's house, and it hurts me because I would have liked to probably bought it myself, but the disease in my family is a money-grabbing bag, and there's no history. I love history. I love my wife's family's history better than mine, but that was something I could have had a little piece of, and the house has been sold, and but I used to go over in the living room and sit and talk with him, and we'd have the best conversations, or I'd watch a football game with him or whatever. And so anyway, we hop in this car, and away we go down the freeway, and I believe I fell asleep at the wheel because it was back when the center rails were done out of the wire, if a lot of the older guys can remember that. We hit that thing, and I don't remember what else happened. All I know is we were upside down on the other side of the freeway. My grandfather was laying on the floorboard, looking like he's bleeding to death, and me was trapped along the side of the wheel. And I'm going, "What happened? How could I do this?" So we ended up in an emergency hospital in Garden Grove, and my dad walked in, and he had that look, like he could kill me if he had a knife. He would have, you know, and he. He grabbed me by the scruff of my shirt. He said, if Grandpa dies, it's your fault and you've ruined this family. I was 17 years old. And until I got here, when I was 34 years old, That was the first thing I thought about every day and the last thing I thought about every day. Honest to God, I did. I never had any days where I didn't. I put myself through self-torture over that. So it didn't matter when my dad acted inappropriately to my future wife, or if my dad was at a bar and he's messing around, you know, or whatever. What right do I have to say anything to anybody? Or if my brother screwed up or my sister's messing around? I was the guy with the referee stripe. I became that for everybody because I killed my own grandpa. He didn't die immediately from that. Within a couple of months, he had a massive heart attack and passed away. All the guys in my family that have died, I've never been there. You know, a lot of men and women talk about that opportunity, being able to be there when someone goes. And I didn't have that opportunity with any of the three of them. So I went on about my business. You know, we got married after I got out of college. It was just like a joke. My dad wanted to be like the Kennedys. He was a Republican, but he loved the Kennedys because they all had this compound they all lived around. He thought it was cool, and they all got along really great. You know, that's what he thought. They don't. And neither did we. So my brother ended up with one of the doctor's houses. My dad built houses for his doctor that would write him illegal prescriptions. And then he built two houses for two different pharmacists, and they were flooding us with pharmaceuticals. I'd come home from school, and there'd be Quaker-made glass bottles of milk and then a brown paper bag, and I'd open it up. It had every kind of Vicodin in it, Valium in it, had everything you can think of. And, you know, I'm a diabetic now, too, today myself. And it's hard for me to get insulin. I got to sign my life away. But, I mean, these were hard narcotics. These guys would bring it, the one pharmacist and the other. And that's the other thing. In my house, we had a really beautiful kitchen. But if you open the cupboards, it looked like a pharmacy. My dad, every surgery that was done, my dad would get some kind of a medication. And it was like never ending. You know, and most of the time it goes for a month or something. These were like years and years of this going on. And the you open up the refrigerator, there's our milk bottles, but the rest was beer and wine and everything else. It looked like a liquor store in there. And my dad's sister owned the local liquor store in town, too. So he had it all dialed in the way that he wanted it. And the funny thing is today, my mom's 90 years old and she lives in that house. And when I lived in it, we had ivy all over it. It looked like the Sleeping Beauty before the prince came and all the ivy went away. It was all overgrown and a mess, and a brown house and really nice house. But we look good on the outside. That's another trait of, I think, a family like mine, an alcoholic family. You look really good on the outside. We really look like the Beaver Cleaver family. I mean, we are heights right, except for my brother because of his medical issues. I'd be taller than him, so I'd change positions with him. We'd all be all dressed up just for Easter and Christmas. We wouldn't go to church otherwise because my dad, he built a rectory for the church that we belong to. And, you know, that was the kind of guy he was. He'd do stuff like that. And on the opening ceremony, he would like to get his accolade for it, of course. Well, they're getting ready to, you know, have this big ceremony, and the minister wasn't there. So I said, where the heck is, you know, this guy at? He said, well, he took all the construction funds and ran off with the showgirl in Las Vegas. So that was the end of our experience. So at our green couch, once again, we're sitting there. How could God do this to me? I do all this stuff, and look what happens. He says, we're not going to church anymore. We'll go on Christmas, and that's it. So, you know, that's what it looked like. But on the outside, it looked like we were all involved in this stuff. But on the inside, our house looked like the DMZ. It was broken stuff all over the place. But then when someone would come in, my mom would work really hard to make it look like a museum. And so it looked like nobody lived there. You know, this doesn't look like our house. What's going on in here? You know, And then, they treat everybody differently than the kids, and all of us would be mixed up. Well, why don't they treat us like that? You know, invite people in, and they're all so nice to them, but when us, you know, we have hell to pay all the time for everything and stuff, so. Anyway, that's kind of how that all went, and the pharmacist, I ended up in one of the pharmacist's house. My brother's house is where the doctors that used to write the prescriptions was, and then my mom's house. But my mom's house today looks like Disneyland, and, you know, it's bright yellow with green trim, and you walk into the kitchen, there's cornflakes, there's very few pills and stuff. Well, she's got a problem with the pills and drinking too, but I'm walking, I called my sponsor, said, you know, this is crazy. I said, I grew up in that house. We never had cornflakes or anything. The pantry, everything looks like it should have when we were growing up. It pisses me off. So it always happens. Normally what happens, his wife, who's also in our fellowship, gets online with me first. So she says, Dan, hold on a minute. I said, what? What, Jane? What do you mean? She says, Your mom put up with all your guys' crap all those years. I said, well, it wasn't that bad. She was part of the problem, too, you know. She said, she's 90 years old, for God's sakes. Doesn't she have a right to be happy if her house wants to be green and beautiful flower beds and all that? Shouldn't she be happy that way? And one more time, I got to see, you know, you get kind of selfish. Even though it's bad growing up there, a lot of things happen. They did the best they could with what they had, you know. And I believe my mom, at 90 years old, she's got enough money to stay in her house. I don't want her to be in a retirement home. If her house wants to be that way, then that's fine with me. But I need a course correction on that every now and then, because I get back to, yeah, but you know what? Look at how it was. And a couple of times I even talked to my mom and sister. I said, don't you remember when Dad was like this? And they go, no, I don't really remember that. I'm going, what did you guys do? I grew up on Venus and you guys grew up on Mars or what? But that's not important either, because I've been here for a long time. My sister's never been here. My dad got sober for just a little while because of my brother-in-law, my wife's brother. And I'm very grateful for that. We don't have much of a relationship at all anymore, but I am so grateful that my dad had a moment of sobriety because of my brother-in-law, who got sober at one point. And, you know, off we go. We get married, and the weddings all had to be conjoined from house to house. And I remember when we finally got married, my brother's wedding, the drywall contractor threw him in the pool, so he was upset about that. And then at my wedding, or our wedding, my dad was over in my backyard with a masonry saw. I said, I'm going to cut a door between your house and Doug's house. That way you can go over there all the time. And my sister-in-law was saying, I don't want him over here all the time. I don't want a damn door put in. So that upset my wife, upset her. And my dad started crying like he would do. Or he'd either give you that look or he'd cry. And so the gate got put in. So we go on our honeymoon, and I come back only 5 days later, mind you, because that's all I took was a five-day honeymoon. I come back and I look at the gate, and I look over. They'd filled the other side back in with block again. It was like an Edgar Allan Poe book. You know, you open it up to the door goes to nowhere. And that door is still there today. I tore out some stuff, and it cracks me up. I look at that door, and I'm going, you know, that's where this took us all. You know, it took us to a door that goes to nowhere. And that's kind of the way our families have been. We work together all the time. I don't do anything holiday-wise with them or anything. I choose to do it with you folks, with people in the fellowship. And you're my family. I love my family of origin in a special way. But I love you guys in a way that's really meaningful. And the life I have today is because of that. And so, you know, we go through all this hoopla. Well, then my sister's wedding was the last one. That was really bad. My dad puts this gigantic pagoda thing in his front yard, and the wedding's going to go on. But the day before, of course, My sister and my brother-in-law, Diane's brother, have all this old baggage. We all went to high school together, and she's trying to act like she's this pristine and never got any problem, but she was doing all kinds of stuff. And so she sends over the guy she's going to marry to tell my wife that her brother is not welcome to the wedding. You don't say anything like that to my wife, because that's all hell breaks loose. And so anyway, I get home from work one day. Said, "You're not going to be in that wedding." I said, "They aren't going to let my brother be there." Blah blah blah. But I couldn't tell my wife. I killed Grandpa, because that's what my thought went to. I killed Grandpa. You don't understand. I couldn't tell her that. But my committee's telling me, "Dan, look at you killed Grandpa. Just don't listen to her. You are obligated to do whatever they want. If they want you to sweep the floors, mow the lawn, whatever, and clean the whole place up, you killed your grandfather. You ruined your family. You got to do that." And that was my mentality. That was my mantra of what I did. So the morning of the wedding, I said, "Where's my tuxedo at?" And my wife said, "I threw it away." I said, "What? What am I going to do now?" I said, "I don't care. I don't care if you're in the wedding or not." So I'm a good liar. I run over to the place and I tell the guy, "Someone stole my car. The tuxedo is in the back. I need a new tuxedo." "Well, man, all I got are leftovers from last night." So he gave me a pair of pants that were the wrong size, the shirt that had a barb stain on it, and a jacket that was too big, but I put that thing on. And I did, and I went to that wedding. And then that wasn't the last of it. The last of it was, I'm all dressed up looking like a hobo, and my wife said, "You got to go tell that guy off right now, you know, that was not acceptable," or whatever. Well, that wasn't the word she used, but that was kind of the idea. My language is a little cleaner today than what that would have been like. So I go, I corner this guy, say, "Look it, that was wrong, blah, blah, blah." And I'm looking at this guy, and he gets all freaked out, and he starts bleeding out of his nose, and he had this white tuxedo on. He got blood all over the front of him. I didn't even hit the guy. And look, I just beat the crap out of him, you know? I've gone, "Oh, man, now what are we going to do? I've really ruined it for everybody." So they delayed the wedding for a while, washed his jacket. I've never wanted to see what that wedding group picture looked like, because it had to be horrendous. I never have. I don't think they even have it. But, man, it was bad. That was a bad deal. So I'm standing up on the podium with them all like this, and I'm looking like, on Willie's side is my in-law family, and on my wife's side is their family. And they're all looking at me like, you ruined everything. And I'm up there thinking, I'm just trying to do good for everybody. Doesn't anybody see that? I killed my grandpa. And I'm trying to, you know, and I'm trying to make it good for everybody. And everybody hates my guts. So when it got done, I think that was the only time I got drunk. I went over to a friend's house and I got so sick and, oh, it was horrible. But, you know, this was the way it was. That's how it was, and it never got any better. And then finally, my brother-in-law called my wife, and he was up in Palos Verdes, and she found him with a shotgun barrel in his mouth, and he's going to kill himself. And she got him to go to College Hospital in Cerritos, and Diane got to hear the Monday night Cerritos panel. At that time, they had a ladies' panel, you know, then they started having family night, and she said, "Well, yeah, family night's great." I said, "Well, can I go?" He said, "No, it's just for the family." That's what she first said. That was like the first date. I'm going, God, I killed Grandpa. They're doing that. Just my list got longer. And now I can't even go to the stuff that's supposed to help everybody, you know? And that's fine. I'll just sit still and watch Star Trek or whatever I did. I don't know. 11 o'clock at night. So anyway, she always was threatening to divorce me. Once I threatened to divorce me if I didn't hire her brother to work. We stole everything from the job, so I had to fire him. And my dad loved him, though. Yeah, I couldn't figure it out at first. Well, he's alcoholic like my dad. You know, they would drink together. He's no good. I don't want him. And the next day, he's the greatest guy in the world. Hire him back. I said, you hire him back. I'm done with that guy. So, you know, anyway, I got to go to Cerritos Monday night. I was forced to go. If I didn't, she said she's going to divorce me. I said, okay. So I sat in the back, like, and taking everybody's inventory. I hated it. I didn't want to be there and all of that. But then I shut up and I put the cotton in my mouth and took it out of my ears, and I started hearing people tell my story. And I'm going, God, this is unbelievable. I said, they must have lived in my house. It's like crazy. And started going. I started to like it. And then my wife said, get this guy for a sponsor, that bald-headed guy. You know, he's always at the convention. We go to a convention planning meeting. So right away, we're not just going to meet him. We're going to step outside the meeting level. I'm going, it's good enough. I like to stay here. No, no, no. We're going to go to the AFG convention planning meeting or something, whatever it was. So Bernie's there, and he, ha, 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 you know, and he's just that kind of guy, you know, and I'm going, this guy's so different than what I grew up with, you know, but he was happy, he was kind, he was gentle, and I was attracted to him as a man. I thought, you know, this guy is really what I need, a guy that's going to show me how to find a God and to be kind and treat people with respect and all that sort of thing. And then about 6 months after we were going pretty faithfully, Diane said, let's try and have a baby. Coming from the mindset I had that I'd killed my best friend and that I was useless, rotten, and no good, I couldn't believe that she said she wanted to do that. So about 9 months later, we had a little girl. I have the only daughter in my family. My brother had two boys, and my sister had two boys. And I'm this tough football wrestler, all this stuff, and I love sports. And I said, well, that'll be okay. I'll be a soccer dad or something, you know, I'll be okay. Well, my daughter ended up being a tap dancer, and then she ends up being a ballet dancer. So what I did, I built ballet props and sewed costumes and all that kind of stuff. I'm a tough guy to that kind of guy. But, you know, I love. My daughter's in New York. She's going to be graduating from Columbia in the spring. She dances. She just like. Thank you, God. Thank you for letting me be a father. And thank you for letting me be a different kind of a dad than my dad was. I know my father loved me. We never hugged or kissed or anything growing up. My daughter came home for Thanksgiving. I couldn't wait to see her at the air, cut off the airplane, gave her a big hug and a kiss. I lived three houses away from my mom, and my daughter never spent a night in my mom's house. That's what the disease of alcoholism does to families. My brother was the youngest licensed architect in California. He died at 55, blind and have gangrene, and he's going to have one of his legs removed and both hands. He couldn't even write with a pencil anymore. That's what the disease of alcoholism does to families. I contracted diabetes when I was 34 years old. I take 4 insulin injections a day. But I do a good job of it because I've learned through the steps and having a sponsor has told me that I'm a precious child of God and that my life should be happy, joyous, and free. And I read an on a conference approved book, A New Pair of Glasses, because I love Chuck C. and I love that book. And I can't believe the stories in there of the places he's worked. I've tore down 2 of the buildings and rebuilt buildings, the buildings he built. You know, I look at all the incredible things that have happened in my life because of this wonderful fellowship and you guys. My wife, I mean, we were mortal enemy. I've gone from being a mortal enemy with my wife before I got here to where she's my best friend today. We both have some health issues going on, you know. We're all, she probably didn't want me to tell her age, but we're going on 60 now, you know. And I want to be with her for a long time still. I got a bad leg problem because of acting like I'm 30 on the job instead of my age. I twisted my ankle really bad, so I'm going through all that stuff right now. But I can do that today. I don't have to do and watch my brother die of chronic diabetes, not take care of himself, and be angry at my dad till the day he died. And I didn't get to be around either one of them when they passed. But my sponsor gave me a real gift. When they died, my dad, of course, first, he said, "Are you going to have some kind of like a wake like the night before?" I said, "I don't know. My mom doesn't want to have a funeral for him." So I said, "Yeah, they're going to have it at the place." He said, "Go over there and just sit and watch the people that come and greet them. I think you'll be kind of amazed." And I got there. My mom and my sister bailed. My sister was loaded or whatever. I'm the only one there. My brother was so pissed at my dad. Even when he was dead, he was mad. I said, "Doug, let it go. He's dead." So they all left. I'm the only one in there. Then all these people start coming in. "Your dad did this for me. Your dad did that for me." You know, that's what the disease does too. They can be kind to other people, but not kind to their own family for some reason. But I know my dad loved me, and I understood that. But that was a gift for me to see all these people come in and tell me, "Your dad did this, and your dad did that." And I said, "Thank you. He was a wonderful man." By the time he died, I knew that. And I could tell him every time I went to see him, "I love you, Dad." That was tough for him at first. He didn't know what to say. Towards the end, he said, "I love you too, Dan. You still go to those meetings, Dan?" I said, "Yeah, Dad." "That's good. I'm glad you do." And about 4 years later, my brother passed. You know, I have diabetes. I know what it looks like. But I'm in denial about watching my brother die. I was up north with my daughter. She's doing a ballet thing, and I got a phone call that my brother died, and I came back. I'm going, "You know, what are we going to do?" I remember my dad saying one of the fear factor things. He said, "Without me, you guys, you're nothing. You're not going to accomplish a thing. You need me." Well, I survived my dad, and then when my brother died, I felt a little more. We take on different traits. My brother was a thief. He stole. He stole from the company. He did a lot of things. But I understand now why he did. Growing up with the kind of antagonism he had from my dad and all that, he never felt worthy. That was what he had to do. Right or wrong, it is what it is. And I love my brother. So I did the same thing with him. I talked to Bernie. I said, "You know, Bernie, I'm going to do the same thing with Doug." He said, "That'd be a good idea." I get there that night. I mean, everybody jumped off like rats off a ship. There's nobody there but me. And I remember what both of their, I don't know what it was. They were both withered up guys, and I don't know what they do when they embalm them or whatever, but my dad's hands looked like they were when they were 40. And my brother's hands looked like it was hands of a healthy man. And I grew, you know, people think it's morbid, or I don't think it is. I grabbed their hand, and I said the Lord's Prayer with them. I said, "I love you guys. Thank you for being my dad. Thank you for being my brother." And the same thing, people came in and said nice things about my brother Doug, too. And the last part of what I did, I buried both of them. Everybody split after the funeral, and I'm waiting around, and the backhoe's there, because we're all construction guys, and they lowered him in, and I said, "Can I help you guys, you know, bury?" So why? So he's my brother or my dad. I like to help. I said, "Okay." So they lowered a ladder down. They dropped some dirt, and I was just going like this. I brought it all the way up, and I helped him put the lawn on both of them. For me, that's what I had to do. It was kind of finality on this earth. We lived a lot of hard life together. But you know what? There were a lot of good things that we did. When I did my fourth step, I had to recall a lot of the good things that happened. You know, my dad put us all through college. But we all worked for him. He had his own reasons for doing things. But I learned my craft well. I know how to build stuff. And I'm grateful for that. Very grateful. And now, I'm working in this fifth generation business. Today, everybody wanted to quit or wanted to raise or whatever. And I was talking to somebody and they said, where are you working, at Walmart or something? I'm going, no, this is my family business. That all these people, they're crazy. It's just another, each generation it seems like it gets worse. You know, it just does. The disease is deeper in a lot of them. And I just go, you know, I need a meeting. And you know what? I get to speak tonight. So how much better does that get? God, thank you so much. Anyway, from where I came from to where I am today, people say, well, it's not really a miracle. It is a miracle for me. Because I've lost family members. I've lost a brother that had the same thing I have. I have nephews that I had no relationship with at all that call me Uncle Dan. I said, when they started work, I said, don't call me Uncle Dan, you guys. Just call me Dan. Okay, Uncle Dan, that's fine. But you know, we have kind of a mutual respect for each other today. And I learned that here. Everybody's special. I might not always agree with what they do, but we're all God's precious children. I truly believe that. And I only, you know, where I'm at today, I only wish good health for all of you. I wish you all a wonderful holiday season. And thank you so much for letting me share.